Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, all you need to do is press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. On Spotlight on Youth, we often look at how juvenile justice response impacts different populations. Today, we're discussing how responses affect American Indian and Alaska Native youth, including focusing on opportunities to prevent delinquency and enhance outcomes. This can be very challenging due to the immense cultural diversity across the tribes. For example, there's 566 federally recognized tribes, the complex jurisdictional issues that may exist, the history of oppression, and the lack of resources available. However, there has been many culturally relevant, innovative programs developed that are successfully helping American, Indian, and Alaska Native children and youth. This issue is not only important for tribes, but many American, Indian, and Alaska Native youth wind up in non-Native courts and institutions. In fact, American Indian youth are grossly overrepresented in juvenile justice systems. Incarcerated Indian youth are much more likely to be subjected to the harshest treatment in the most restrictive environments and less likely to have received the help they need from other systems. And they are more likely, I think by 50% that I read, than white youth to receive the most punitive measures. Today, both guests work at the Education Development Center, Inc., or called EDC, which is a global nonprofit organization that designs, delivers, and evaluates programs to address some of the world's most urgent challenges in education, health, and economic development. Our guests are Jerry Rainingberg, who is an enrolled member of the Chippewa Cree Tribe of Rocky Boy. He has been involved with American Indian Alaska Native education, health, and wellness promotion for over 25 years. His educational background includes a bachelor's in physical education and health and a master's in education administration. Jerry's professional experience has ranged from being a high school teacher, coach, and administrator to wellness consultant, workshop trainer, mentor, and group facilitator. He has extensive experience in community development and capacity building, positive youth development, Native teaching and learning styles, traditional storytelling, and program development. Jerry has worked with more than 200 Native communities all across Indian Country and the Pacific Islands. In his most recent roles, he has served as a sustainability coordinator, training and technical assistance coordinator, senior tribal prevention specialist, and director of a national tobacco prevention network, where he was named the Community Activist of the Year in 2003 by the American Legacy Foundation. Jerry is also a grass dancer in the powwow circle and is a proud father of two college graduates, Jeremiah Sits in the Sky and Lindsay Little Whirlwind Woman. Also joining us is Stephanie Autumn, who currently serves as the project director for the Tribal Youth Training and Technical Assistance Center, the Tribal Juvenile Detention Reentry Green Training and Technical Assistance Center, as well as the seventh generation National Tribal Mentoring Project at EDC. She has 35 years of experience in grant administration for urban and reservation American Indian tribes and community agencies in the areas of social services, housing and homelessness, criminal justice, and culturally based education projects integrated with public and alternative schools. For the past 20 years, Stephanie's professional work has concentrated on violence reduction, crime prevention, and restorative justice strategies in urban and reservation communities. She has worked to create partnerships between court services, legislators, public defense, law enforcement, schools, and community-based agencies, and has testified before the United Nations legislative committees and subcommittees on effective culturally-based services for incarcerated American Indian youth and adults in Minnesota and South Dakota. She holds a bachelor's in elementary education and is currently working on a master's in public policy. And I don't know why I don't have this down in front of me, but I believe, Stephanie, you are enrolled in the Hopi tribe. So it is an honor to have you both on today's show. Welcome very much.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
when we're talking about American Indian, Alaska Native children and youth, who are we talking about? What do we mean?
Well, as many people know, in Indian country, a lot of folks will self-identify as being Native or being a blend or a mixture or having different ethnic backgrounds associated with them. But generally, we're talking around 4 million American Indian self-identified people in the U.S. according to the last census. And over 50% of those are younger than 21. So we're talking about over 2 million young people who are American Indian or Alaska Native. Or you can look at the other figures that are represented through some of the reporting entities, and they indicate that there are a little over 2 million American Indian, Alaska Native folks. And so it ranges, but they're all over the country, up in Alaska, but primarily they are found in our urban Indian centers because of the relocation policies back in the 40s and 50s. And so it's a wide range, and you cannot tell usually whether someone is American Indian, Alaska Native, unless they tell you that, just because of the many different ways that our Indian people have evolved over the last century.
Yep. And I would just like to add on to what Jerry's saying, is it's really important that when we talk about American Indian and Alaska Native, federally recognized tribes and federally recognized tribal members, that with that it comes a distinct political, social relationship and political relationship that we have with the United States of America. We have dual citizenship. We have citizenship within our tribal nations and within the United States of America.
And that's a good point, Steph.
Go
what I also would like to mention is that, Lauren, you indicated that there were 566 federally recognized tribes. In addition to those tribes that have a formal, historical, and treaty-based relationship with the U.S. government, there are a number of tribes, especially in California, where there are over 100 tribes that are state-recognized but are not federally recognized.
And maybe just in case our listeners are not very familiar with this issue, when you do come from a federally recognized tribe, what does that mean? And what, especially since jurisdictional issues can be something that we talk about when it comes to juvenile justice, maybe you can explain how, you know, there's inherent rights of self-government and what the differences are there.
Well, I think the most important thing to recognize, because it's not taught in public schools, it's not taught in our college systems, is that all federally recognized tribes have their own form of government that they operate from, and within that comes its own programs, system, healthcare service, law enforcement, tribal courts, etc. So we operate on a government-to-government relationship within the United States, and within the states that are traditional homelands, our reservation lands, because a lot of our tribes have been removed from their traditional homelands. Within those lands, we have a different legal and political relationship within the county and with the state.
Great. Thank you very much. And I think we'll probably be discussing this as we continue on with the show and how that history impacts and continues to impact how we are helping youth. I know NPR did a story a few years ago really covering the everyday reality of many Native families, although it was shocking to, I guess, many other people, that in South Dakota alone, 700 youth were removed annually by the child welfare system there. And so, you know, turning to this issue of why is it imperative that we're holding this show and that we're discussing the prevention intervention of American Indian and Alaska Native children and youth.
So I think it's important to note, and that's, I think, unfortunately, if folks don't have the historical and political background in terms of the relationship that tribes have with the United States government are some of the historical context to frame it in terms of why we are located where we're located now, and around the need for our land, the need for our resources. And when we look at where we are at in the year 2013, is that need for our land and that need for our resources, mineral, oil, water, timber, continues to impact our social, economical, and political, educational livelihood. And where we are have been removed to or forced to live to, for the most part, is now usually in the most remote areas with the least amount of resources. And when you're talking about building an infrastructure within an infrastructure, so we have nations within nations here in the United States, American Indians, Alaska Natives, even though it's somehow justified because our populations have been ever shrinking over the 50 years, is that we are at the bottom in terms of resources, even though it's guaranteed by treaty rights in terms of education, health, welfare, justice, law, resources that should be coming to our tribal nations because of the acquisition of our lands, the takeover of our lands. It's been very hard to develop strong infrastructures, whether it's health or law, because of the limited resources that we have today.
And I would just like to add that when you look at the historical context of the federal Indian policy and the impact it's had on our many Native nations, just the simple philosophy behind the idea that kill the man, save the Indian, you know, it was just a really traumatic historical experience for our Native nations in dealing with the policies of the federal government. And even to this day, there's still a very large segment of our populations that are dealing with that experience intergenerationally. And it still has the severe impacts of what Steph has just described. And one of the most important things that we need to realize is that the U.S. used English as their primary mode of communication. And in the days of the treaty making, when Native folks were the primary landholders and caretakers of this country, that was used against them. The introduction of alcohol, especially, really, really transformed negotiations, and the U.S. government got away with millions and millions of acres of land and resources, and our Indian people have been struggling to regain that ever since. And so in that, we've always tried to regain a sense of cultural integrity using our own practices, ceremonies, revitalizing our languages, and ensuring that what we've been through isn't going to destroy us. It's in fact going to make us stronger and more resilient in our efforts to continue the legacy that the ancestors have always had for us. And so I think when we take a look at those opportunities and the historical significance of the events in our history, as many people have indicated over the years, we cannot determine where we're going until we've realized what we have been through, and then to chart a path that is going to bring back all of those cultural protective factors that have enabled us to survive all these centuries, even with respect to all of the different ways in which our cultures, our communities, our nations have been bombarded with to take apart our cultural integrity.
And you just bring, you know, it just brings to light a great point in order to put this conversation into context, because I know oftentimes I hear in dominant society, well, they just need to get over it. They need to, you know, we need to adjust. We need to do all these things. But I think it's critically important for dominant society to understand that before colonization, before oppression, before the wars against us, we had intact our own intact indigenous systems of justice, education, strong family, community, relationships, and then to with the oppression and wars and colonization, when that is removed, it's almost like we are trying to, as you said, Jer, we're doing nation building now. So you take indigenous cultures that were healthy and well and whole, declimate them by removal from traditional homelands, the breakup of the family in terms of forced relocation, boarding schools, forced Western systems that don't work for indigenous people. They barely work for Western society. And then you in remote areas of the United States now with very limited resources, and then say, hey, why are your young people, you know, why is this happening to your young people? Why is this happening to your families? Because not only are we trying to deal with how Western society is impacting our communities, we're doing it on limited resources, and we're doing nation building, our rebuilding in the same breath. You know, so we're tasked with multiple issues that Western society normally doesn't have to grapple with in cities or communities.
And before we sort of turn to, I mean, we're going to talk about how the process now of reclaiming culture and integrating that into responses to build resiliency. I do still want to explore sort of how the current system has continues to be abusive to children, and why it's not working. And you're laying a terrific foundation for explaining the impact of how we of what the tribes are dealing with and what Native families are dealing with today, and why we have the stats of the suicide rates are twice as high, and how the systems are continually, really forcibly removing kids from their communities. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about that issue to give more context to the efforts that now that you two have been working on to change that.
I think it's important to realize that while in the United States that we have a lot to cheer and champion in terms of where the United States is in terms of, you know, equal rights or human rights, but we also have a lot of work to go. And oftentimes as a Native person, I just get so frustrated because there is always talk about human rights, civil rights around African Americans and Hispanic, Latinos, Asian Americans, rightly so, but Indigenous American Indians, Alaska Natives, we are still struggling for those same civil rights, human rights in our reservation border towns, in cities, and it spills over into the justice system in terms of arrest rates, incarceration rates, dual systems of justice for American Indian adults and juveniles in border towns, in large cities that reservations bump up against. Because of all, I believe, what we really have to look at because of the history of the United States and the importance of our land and the importance of our resources is it's the unspoken civil human rights issue. America does not want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it in the justice system. We throw programs at it. We throw services at it. We don't talk to it in the breath that we should around civil rights and human rights and the impact of the juvenile justice system and the adult justice system as it pertains to American Indians and Alaska Natives here in this country.
And in addition to that, I would like to add that when we talk about the infrastructure, we talk about resources available to our Native communities, especially in our criminal justice systems, there is an often a lack of staff, qualified folks, and even our own people sometimes, if they're put in those positions of authority where it comes to corrections, what I'll talk about later is this intergenerational trauma that has impacted our communities is manifested in those roles and the way in which they are operating. It comes across as being very, very dictative, very negative, and unfortunately, it's based on a non-native philosophy of restorative justice and this idea that we look at the strengths of our community rather than the challenges and come from that particular perspective. And so I would like to say that when we look at what we would call internalized oppression, it's being manifested oftentimes in our criminal justice systems that are there to serve our youth, but in fact are really having a negative impact. And so I think one of the ways in which we've been working really hard to contradict that is coming from that traditional perspective that we are all of value, we all have a part in the circle, there's a certain purpose that we are subscribing to, and that it will come about if we enable and empower our young people to be who they really are and to identify the critical elements behind that positive youth development, which we'll be talking about in a bit. But I just wanted to point that out as well.
No, that's really terrific. And I would ask you, Jerry, to maybe give some examples of, before we get to how you are rectifying that and what you're doing, but empowering youth and tribes to do that. I think it's really important for listeners to have a better understanding. If you can give some examples of how then the current response is what you're talking about, sort of preying on this internalized oppression and how it's having the negative effects. And Stephanie, I would ask you to do the same when you were talking about sort of the jurisdictional issues. If you can give some examples of how that then has negatively impacted youth, I think that would be really helpful for people, because I know people don't even know that if something happened, let's say I was working on domestic violence issues and a Native woman was abused by a non-Native, that the tribe may not, till very recently, have any jurisdiction over that person, right? So if you can give, both of you give examples so that people can better understand what you're talking about, and then we'll move into some of the innovative things that you've been doing.
Sure. One prime example that many of our Native people are extremely familiar with, and that is the boarding school experience. Back in the late 1800s, when the U.S. was negotiating treaties with the American Indian nations, one of the elements that they put in place to hinder the sovereignty and the independence of our Native communities was to send their young children off to boarding schools, many of them whom were younger than 5 years old. And in these boarding schools that were usually led by non-Native folks who had a very, very a different idea of what they should be learning, what they should be how they should be behaving and how they should be treated than the way we did in our homelands, resulted in many of our young people, one, being punished for using their language, two, being separated from their families. And I'm not just talking about just for small periods of time, a nine-month period when school is in session, but sometimes it's stretched into years. So that many of our young people back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were taken away from their parents, sometimes without explanation, without time to really say goodbye or have ceremony to see and to experience how that would affect them, and giving them opportunities to learn what to expect and how to deal with those experiences. But it just turned into this long, long period of time where our young people, now who are our elders, were subjected to all kinds of punishment, negative discipline, and removal, and basically isolated from their community, culture, ceremonies, rituals, language, and their relationships were totally broken. And then to be given that release to go back to the communities after they put in their time, they were totally devastated by that experience and oftentimes did not know who their families were, who their relations were, forgot their language, or sometimes even for those who managed to escape back home to be with family would oftentimes be tracked down and taken back and punished for that. And so there was that long, awful history of the boarding schools that really, really had a huge negative impact on our people, and that trauma has manifested itself in our relationships even to this day. If they haven't been addressed in some way, those negative values, those negative experiences continue to rise to the surface in our relationship with each other, and that's one of the reasons why we have such devastating experiences with our young people and even with our adults and folks who have had that experience.
Stephanie,
so, Lauren, if I was
add?
Understanding, you were also asking about some jurisdictional, try to frame this up in some current jurisdictional piece that the listeners could understand. I think it's important to note, you know, with as many federally recognized and non-recognized tribes, you know, jurisdiction over land, jurisdiction over tribal members, it can be very complex. And there's what's called Public Law 83-280, which was enacted by, I think, the 82nd Congressional Congress, I may have that wrong, but it was really a transfer of federal power to state government, and it's different state to state, and it was like, why was Public Law 280 enacted? It was just kind of like that changing pendulum that happens with the federal government in terms of what they deem is good for Indian people and or what really benefits the United States of America. So if I take the Minnesota, where I live, which has 11 federally recognized tribes, and 10 of those tribes fall under Public Law 280, which means local and county law enforcement can, you know, come on into the tribal community and make arrests. There's only one tribe in Minnesota, that's Red Lake Nation, the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe, that have complete tribal authority and law enforcement cannot come in on unless it's under the 10 Major Crime Act. So it gets very complicated when we're talking about juveniles. So before I came to EDC, my whole past was dedicated to prison work and juvenile justice. So just if I look at Minnesota as a reference point. So most reservations in most states are in the remote areas. So if we have a young person, and this story that I'm about to tell, I think is a pretty typical profile for a young Native or Alaska Native getting involved in the juvenile justice system. Most of the youth that I work with, it starts out like in status offenses, or a young person removed from the home and placed into a foster home, and the young person runs. The young person gets picked up and gets put into another foster home, then a group home. Then the young person runs again, but this time they steal a car. And somehow as they keep trying to get home or back to their family, they keep getting these charges, these status and now non-status charges on them. More often than not, they will wind up in a county or state facility. In the state of Minnesota, there's two facilities, one in the southwestern part of Minnesota, Red Wing Correctional Facility, and one near Bemidji, which is closer to the tribes. And I worked providing services to the youth at Red Wing. So you have young people from these 11 tribes in this juvenile facility, and we know for any developing youth, family and family contact is so important. And we know that most families, one, don't have cars, don't have the economic resources to travel 300 miles one way to see their child. So we see this pattern across Indian country of young people, you know, as they graduate from status offense to other type of charges, not being in their home communities and being placed outside of their and justice systems outside of their home communities with little support from their tribe, little support from their families, and these juvenile justice correctional facilities become the breeding ground to really how to be a better criminal, how to learn more, how to become more hardened, how to become more disconnected from your community, from your culture, so that when you leave, you're actually better at being criminal, you're better at how to survive on the streets than really how to make it in society. You know, and that's, I feel, is the backdrop of most of the issues that we're seeing in the juvenile justice system, and then you take the justice systems, the juvenile justice systems that are being run by the counties and states, that even in this day and age, because this is America and there is not much credence given to the importance of culture and cultural sensitivity and cultural inclusion and cultural best practices for Native people and recognizing the wisdom that tribes have regarding prevention and intervention and transformation of young people. So they are put through these rigorous Western programs that they don't succeed at. That so you see our young people staying in detention centers three times as long as other Caucasian and other populations of color. You see them in the segregation part of the juvenile facility at a higher rate. You see the recidivism rates, and it's just if we could just wake up, if Western society could just wake up and see that there are better pathways in terms of helping young people to heal from their trauma, to learn new skills, and then to re-enter, whether it's their community or a Western community, in a way that will be successful. But it's as though it's either this way or no way. And so we keep seeing, you know, it's that definition of insanity. People want to see change with our youth and adults in the system, but until the system changes and embraces and partners with tribal best practices, we're just going to keep seeing the same sort of outcomes of a lack of success of our young people and adults being able to re-enter their community in a healthy and whole way.
And we did have a question from a listener that sort of takes us into some of more of the best practice on the intervention side, and then maybe we can backtrack into the prevention. So the question first is, do the tribes have their own facilities and programs to intervene with youth as like detention centers, and what are the differences between that and correctional facilities that would be operated by a state or a county? That's the question from
currently,
a listener.
Currently, there are 21 tribal juvenile detention centers within the United States. So when you take, you know, whatever our number is, 566, you know, it changes depending on who's doing the counting of tribes, and you take the number of tribally run facilities, it's just a drop in the bucket. But you know, but tribes do have, you know, intervention and prevention programs within their own communities to respond to juvenile justice, juvenile delinquency needs. And Jerry, I don't know if you want to start us out with sharing some of those.
Sure. Thank you, Steph. And yes, there has always been in every one of our Native communities around Indian country that have had what we would call tribal best practices. And I want to make the distinction that these practices have been around for generations and generations. And unfortunately, over time, some of them were not practiced because of the interventions and the U.S. policy against American Indians. But regardless, many of our nations have always practiced these different ceremonies, rituals, these activities that enables our young people to learn the values, the philosophy, the reasons for being, healthy relationships, community development, and looking at responsibilities for adulthood and beyond to elderhood. One in particular is the canoe journey out here in the Northwest. Currently, there are a good number of Native Nations all over Northern California, Oregon, Washington, up into Canada, are right now in the midst of the canoe journey. And basically, it's the tradition of many of these Native Nations along the coast that have taken time out to go out and develop relationships with other Native Nations bordering the West Coast, honoring the process of gifts of the sea, the coastlands, and honoring each other as a way of developing positive relationships for the future. And even just the simple act of how to paddle, the relationship you have with that canoe, the elders, the teachers, the young people that are also paddling with you, there are certain protocols that you follow that ensure that you will reach your destination in a safe manner. And there's just these preparations that provide, especially our young people, reasons for what we do, who we are, and why we do what we do. And it's considered to be a practice that, again, promotes resiliency. It fosters sustainability. It creates opportunities for healthy communications, and it also empowers young people to become physically fit, emotionally stable, and to have a distinct connection to our elders as they teach, as they experience. And the best way to learn is through having fun, through laughter, and through experience. And based on my training as a teacher, as a coach, a facilitator, there's just no better way to engage a young person on the way to healthy adulthood than to have them be a part of the responsibility of decision-making and seeing that vision that our ancestors have always had for us. And so that's one, and I'll talk about another one in a bit, but I think Steph would also probably like to add to that.
Yes, I think as I just think about, you know, the diversity across Indian country in terms of the intervention and prevention approaches, you know, there's equine therapy that's being widely used across Indian country, rites of passage, integrating the cultural arts into daily opportunities for our young people, ceremonies and restorative practices. That all, because the other part of my life has been spent in trying to educate and integrate restorative practices within juvenile and adult detention prison facilities. And restorative practices are built on indigenous concepts and philosophy. And they're like, I always say, if Western society could embrace restorative practices, the talking circles, the family group, decision-making, conferencing, the mediation models that are there, we could, you know, cut the incarceration rate of our young people by at least 30% to 40%, because mm-hmm. you're really front-ending the conflict. You're not only intervening, doing prevention and educating, but you're creating through restorative practices that sacred space, that place where young people can be transformed, because that's what we're really talking about, is giving young people a place to learn from their mistakes and transform themselves to make better choices, which then takes you into the realm of working with young people, not about what they're doing wrong, but what they do right, and empowering, you know, their own inherent wisdom, whether it's from their family or their community, from their nation, to be the next leaders, making that place for them. And that when young people feel that they have a place and they have a responsibility, you see that transformation shift. So, you know, there, I think there's those type of, you know, intervention, prevention things that we could either call services or programs, but I think it's important to think of the bigger picture, that it's not only being able to provide that, but to also think about what systems change has to take place, because you can do those type of interventions, but if they're not coupled in the conversation, like you were saying, Jer, that that it's trauma-informed care, recognizing that 80% of our communities are dealing with some sort of personal, family, or community collateral trauma that is really at the root of the behavior. We'll keep treating the behavior, and we really never take care of the root, kind of like homeopathy. Let's get down to the root, and then we can get rid of the disease. And then also looking at how do we transform our systems. And instead of having systems that respond to young people and adults in the justice system or in prison, that they work through like a compatible systems of care that are, as you said, Jerry, strength based and asset building. It's not only a different way to deal with the individual, but it's saying, again, we have to transform these archaic Western systems that are in place to really dismantle. My dream, and I say it every day, and I'll say it until I crossed into the spirit world, is every day I say, I pray that in 20 years from now that there will be no prisons in Indian country, because it has not been that long that there were no prisons among our people. We had a way of dealing with disharmony. We had a way of helping people who were out of balance. We did not put them in cages. We did not kill them. So it's always my prayer that we are going to transform these systems and get back to where we were 100 years ago in dealing with disharmony and unhealth and unbalance.
And have you seen glimpses of system transformation that gives you hope? And that question is for both of you.
I'll catch my breath, Jerry, and you can go.
Sure, absolutely. And yes, there are many examples all across Indian country where the changes and just the return to traditional practices have empowered and enabled our people to get back on track to who we really are and what we're about. And one of those practices came about back in 1994, around that time, a little over 20 years ago, where a group of healthy, well, Native adults came together under the funding of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, our agency, SAMHSA. There was some incidents that were taking place that were just really, really having, again, an impact on our communities. And this group of people came together, and they talked and they shared. They conducted focus groups, interviews with their respective colleagues and coworkers and community members, elders, young people. And that's how the gathering of Native Americans came about, what we call the Gona, or the Gone, up in Alaska, the gathering of Alaska Natives. And the best practice of Gona, really, the foundation of that is honoring each and every individual, honoring our history, honoring our relationships, and getting back to what really strengthened our communities, and understanding that there's reality to deal with, the historical trauma, but if we do it in a way that's respectful of our hurts, our pains, and our grieving that may have been unresolved, in addition to that, looking at our humor, our stories, our songs, our dances, our language, and bringing those together in a way that sets a really good environment, a safe environment for people to come together, and to go through a healing process that's community-wide, that's tribally-wide, and that fosters some healthy relationships between elders and young people, between parents and their children, and between siblings, between relatives. And so I just really emphasize that this practice is based on Native philosophies, Native beliefs, and Native understanding of the world. And so when you bring them together as a whole community, powerful things happen. We start the first day where we make sure that everyone feels safe, secure, and that they're part of the group. We talk about our commonalities as a tribe, as a nation, our beliefs that made us strong back in the day, and ones that which we wish to return and have some relationship with, and we spend that whole first date doing those fun things that make people feel at ease, comfortable, and safe. And then we talk about what do we need to know, what do we need to do to ensure that we have the skills and we have the knowledge and understanding to move forward. And we talk about what broke apart our world. We talk about the historical trauma, the internalized oppression, all those things, but with the intent that the next step after that is what? How do we bounce back from that? How do we develop resiliency? And how do we develop mindfulness to ensure that that does not continue and that we can nip it in the bud and move towards the positive side of things? And looking at, our songs, our dances, our language, our experience with adversity and overcoming those challenges that have faced our ancestors, and bringing back that positive sense of Indianness, and then teaching our people to make that a practice, an everyday practice, so that they are feeling competent, confident, and with a sense of purpose. And once that's established, we go through these different activities and scenarios and role plays and opportunities where people become much more comfortable with who they are and where they've been, and then where are they going. And the final stage of the healing process is what we call generosity, where on the final day of our gatherings, we bring the people together and offer them an opportunity to tell us, what are you going to do now? What is your intent? What is your commitment to ensure that your responsibility to the community continues and that people can hold you to it in a respectful, mindful manner? And once that's completed, the community has a nationwide action plan that they follow, and periodically they will have these events, maybe annually or biannually. As a matter of fact, there's a group of young people in Northern California right now basically having gone through the GONA as young Native youth who really have a vision for their community and want to be the positive force that's going to have positive effects on the future generations of our people. And it's just a dynamic process. We have reached over 200 communities over the past 20 years, and it's growing, and we just hope that people will recognize our own tribal best practices as the way to go.
Sounds terrific.
And to add to that, two concrete examples in terms of tribal court, I think Indian Country is doing some remarkable changes within our tribal courts to embrace a more indigenous model of justice. The Red Lake Nation in Minnesota, in their juvenile program for youth offenders, they have what's called the CRAFT program. So young people that are involved in the juvenile justice system are referred to their tribal youth program. And in this program, they learn how to make traditional crafts. They do maple syruping. They do wild ricing. They do traditional hunting camps. They learn these skills, and they make these items. And every quarter, they then hold a community feast, and they share these gifts, the young people, with the individuals that they harmed in their juvenile offenses. They make their amends publicly, and they give them this gift and try to restore and be in a better relationship with those that they've harmed. I think that's a remarkable program. And the Winnebago tribe, the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin, they have instituted within their tribal courts a council of elders for juveniles and adults, instead of it just being like, you know, a judge. So they bring in the elders to hear about the disharmony or the offenses that the young people and the adults have done, and they get back to traditional roots of how to repair that harm, how to make amends, how to restore the relationship and the balance within the community. A lot of tribal courts within Indian Country are adapting peer court models where young people are given the skills and leaderships to be listening to the offensive and the harms and really help that young person to understand their responsibility, how to repair that harm for whatever brought them into court. So I think we could probably take three radio stations, but there are a lot of innovative programs and best practices out there that American Indian Alaska Native communities are implementing in their own community to utilize in their social and justice system.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we'd be thrilled to have both of you on again. So you opened the door, Stephanie, to a few more shows. But I wanted to know if both of you would share maybe some recommendations. First of all, listeners from Indian Country right now who are listening to you and saying these are great ideas, what are some thoughts you may want to share with them about how to take this and get started? And then also for the non-Native community who may be in juvenile justice working in the systems or who want to be allies, what words of recommendations do you have for them who want to better assist Native American and Alaska Indian youth?
I'll take the easiest part and share some resources because that's part of what I do. Right. A couple of websites that there are tons, you know, again, just a ton of resources around best practices for young people in the JJ juvenile justice system are involved, you know, in delinquency, are not succeeding in some way. The first website is www.tribalreentry.org, and there's like 323 resources there. All innovative practices, people in the field, consultants, trainers, et cetera. And then another resource would be the www.tribalyouthprogram.org, and it's a host of resources of tribal youth programs across the country and programs and resources and tools that are being utilized to create healthier opportunities and communities for young people.
Great. And I want to add the website for the organization that you both work for is edc.org in case anyone wants more information about that.
Yeah.
Other thoughts, Jerry, on my question? I know it's a large question with little time, but just wanted to get a few things that people may start thinking about.
Sure, absolutely. And I would just say this to our non-Native listeners, to be an ally and an advocate for young Native people's rights, and especially looking at how you can be an instrument to getting positive things done, I would suggest getting in contact with, if you are near a Native community, contacting their human resources department or their health department, our social services, and get in touch with someone there. Describe your interest and your sincere desire to be of assistance in some way. I would discourage people from coming out and saying that they are part Cherokee, or that their grandmother was a Cherokee princess. We've heard that too many times, and it really puts you in a position of embarrassment, and people won't take you seriously. So I would shy away from that, but just be honest about just having a sincere desire to be of some kind of support, whether it's to go and be a part-time instructor or to help do research or to help develop letter-writing campaigns, fundraising, et cetera. It depends. But that's one of the best ways is to do it slowly, deliberately, and humbly, to be mindful of that history of distrust, mistrust, and broken promises that our nations have experienced. And so please don't be offended that they may be a little resistant and hesitant or suspicious. What will really, really help is perseverance and taking the time to develop that relationship and to be respectful, mindful of that history and that experience. And once that's established, you have best friends for life. Our Native people are filled with humor. they really do have a sense of loyalty and dedication to the community. And once that wall has been opened up, you will be a part of the community, and you'll be loved and appreciated and respected for that. And so that's how I would approach our communities. And if there isn't one nearby, if you're in the urban areas, we have urban Indian centers in just about every major city in the country. And those folks are more than happy to welcome people who want to volunteer, or again, to serve in some capacity that empowers our young people and the community to be more independent and to be more open to living in that environment and prospering. And so those are some of the things that I would suggest that our non-Native listeners can do.
Okay, and just in the final...
And the only thing that I would like to add that is that oftentimes Western society, because of the stereotypical, you know, either seeing that ironized Cody with the teardrop coming down his face, or, you know, a poor, disheveled Native person sitting on the side of the road, is greet us from a place of strength. Know that we have more assets and more strength than we have weaknesses. And know that we love our people, know that we love our land, know that we really do try to embrace the words that we are all related, meaning all human beings, all races, and it's critically important that we work together in that way in order for the earth to survive, in order for all populations of people to survive in a good way, all of our children.
Well, we're at final thoughts. Stephanie, you said that, you know, you hope one day there's going to be no prisons in Indian Country. So just want to hear briefly from both of you maybe your hopes for continued changes and any final thoughts.
Well, I'll go ahead and go first and just say that, you know, our Native people have experienced a great deal of challenges over the years, but while doing so, we've maintained our humor. We've maintained our languages. Initially, there were over 500 Native languages that we estimate were in place around the time that Columbus was lost and found himself somewhere in Central America Island. And since then, some of our languages obviously have been forgotten, disappeared, not by choice. But there's programs and communities that are revitalizing that effort, are reconnecting, and are strengthening their language programs, because without our languages, we oftentimes aren't familiar and aren't knowledgeable about the true meanings behind our relationships with the earth, with other people, with other beings, and needing that connection to foster a mindful relationship. And I use the word mindful a lot just because it's something that every person can do. It's something that everyone has an opportunity to learn from and to be humble about, again, our role and how powerful this role is. And I would also add that when we talk about our Native people, our ancestors really had a challenging environment, but they survived. And every time I work with young people, one of the last things I tell them is that they are the best of the best, meaning that their relatives, their ancestors, experienced all kinds of efforts to wipe them off the face of the earth, but they persevered, they were resilient, they relied on their creativity, their bravery, their intelligence, and their adaptability. And those values, those skills, those traits and characteristics were passed on to those who survived. And those folks are us. And our young people that are born to us continue that. And so they are the best of the best. And it's up to them to continue that effort and to know that there's all these ancestors behind their efforts, and that we have a really rare opportunity to continue something that makes us distinct, that makes us the true natives of this community, and to return to that role of being responsible, not just for who we are, but for those who are to come after us.
Great. Thank you, Stephanie.
I think Jerry said it all, and I am happy to conclude with that.
Well, I really want to thank both of you for joining today. It's been a wonderful, truly wonderful show. So thank you for being on. I hope you will consider coming on for another show and sharing more success stories and helping us think how we can be innovative in our approaches to all youth.
Great.
Our
thank
next
you,
show,
for having us on.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next show, we will be examining efforts around crossover youth, which are youth that have been both in the juvenile justice and child welfare systems. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Goodbye. Thanks again.